not backing down.
Good evening. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for Wednesday, March 29th, 2017.
Tenant.
Power.
Tenant.
Power.
Tenant.
Power.
Woo! It's a good day. It's a good
There's
day.
There's good news in New York City for rent-regulated apartments with one-year leases. A ruling by New York State Supreme Court Justice Deborah James keeps a rent freeze in place for those units. The decision is in the Rent Stabilization Association's lawsuit. It upholds a Rent Guidelines Board decision, which froze rents on one-year leases of rent-stabilized apartments. The RCA, which represents landlords of buildings containing regulated rental units, they challenged the RGB's decision to continue the freeze of increases from the previous year. The rental rates for stabilized apartments are set by decisions the Rent Guidelines Board makes on a yearly basis. But according to the chair of the City Council's Housing Committee, Jamani Williams, for about five decades, landlords got increases.
For 2 years, just two, there have been rent freezes and they're crying like babies. This is purely about greed. That is all it is about. All of the numbers show that the rent freezes were the right thing to do. And to show you how much greed and power will do to keep it, they went to court to try to stop rent freezes for 2 years out of nearly 50. That is reprehensible, I believe, to the extent of what power and greed will do to hold on to it. We are not saying we don't want people to make money. I want people in New York City who own buildings, who have business, to make money. But what we are saying is you cannot be greedy to try to make all of the money off of the backs of the people who can't afford it, off of the backs of the people who made New York City what it is today when nobody wanted to be here. And for many years, we have been asking the Rent Guidelines Board, don't skip over the question of whether there should be a rent freeze to begin with. They always went straight to don't skip over the question of whether there should be a rent increase to begin with. They always went straight to how much the rent increase should be. And we said, well, let's figure out whether there should be one to begin with. And an amazing thing happens when you decide to be fair. You get results like this. The landlord lobby actually began to argue that the only thing that should be considered is the landlord side. That in this system, we shouldn't look at what the tenants are going through at all. What sense does that make? And for nearly 50 years, they've won that argument. And when you look at the data, there have been times the question was, in any economic environment, they deserved to have an increase. That just didn't make any sense. When he looked at the oil, when he looked at their costs, whether it went up, whether it went down, they had an increase. And what we said is that is unfair. We should be fair. Look at what tenants are going through. This is an entire system. And we saw what happened. And I want to put it in context, because in this day and age, with the orange man in charge, there are a lot of things going on in this country and in this city, and it is up to municipalities to be the first line of defense against that. I was happy to see a victory in the Congress for the ACA, and I'm happy to see a victory here for the tenants. And I know the orange one promised that they'd be winning, but we're winning now, and I'm looking forward to more and more and more wins.
The Rent Stabilization Association, representing 25,000 landlords of 1 million rent-stabilized apartments, says it plans to appeal the rent freeze decision. In other news, Mayor Bill de Blasio went to the Fortune Society, which provides reentry services and alternatives to incarceration. He announced new initiatives meant to help draw down recidivism in city jails. It's a three-prong approach the city is trying. First, it will increase education and training from 1 to 5 hours each weekday. And it will provide reentry services for all who leave prisons. And for those convicted of a crime, there will be 2 months of transitional employment. The mayor has budgeted $10 million for this. Stanley Richards is executive vice president of the Fortune Society. He's living proof that alternatives to incarceration work. He went from Rikers to upstate prisons, but then he was able to break the cycle of recidivism.
I dropped out of school. I got involved in selling drugs. I got involved in using drugs. I got involved in devastating my community. And for all my life, I thought that prison was going to be a way of life. It wasn't until my last incarceration when I went to school and I obtained my GED. And that GED told me that everything I heard about who I am and who I could be was wrong. Then I went to college and I graduated from college. I graduated magna cum laude. And I went from this kid from Soundview who thought that my life would be always about incarceration to believing that my life could be different, that my life, in my hands, things could be different. All I needed was an opportunity. When I came home from prison, fortune provided me with that opportunity, and I started here as a counselor. I tell you, every single day, we get to do a couple of things here that's pretty amazing. One, we get to create the world we wish we lived in, right in this space. Two, we get to see the beauty in people sometimes before they see it in themselves. I know there was a time in my life when I didn't see the beauty in me. And three, we get to treat people the way we want to be treated.
Richard says new initiatives give people a second chance.
When I was 14 years old, I made some mistakes that landed me on Rikers Island.
22-year-old Leviticus was able to participate in an alternatives to incarceration program at the Fortune Society.
But upon my release, I knew where I wanted to go, but I just didn't have the resources to get there. Like, it was so hard for me. I didn't know where to go to get an identification card. I didn't know where I would be attending school upon my release. I didn't know what a bank account or how to go about a bank account or manage money or do any of those things. I didn't know. When I got to Fortune Society, I had a counselor that was on top of me about things, getting things done, pointing me in the right directions, basically steering me on the right track so I won't derail and re-enter where I just left from, as far as Rikers Island. And doing those things, when I got to Fortune, I knew I wanted to go back to school. I knew I wanted to get job readiness program. I knew I wanted to do all these things, but I didn't know where to go or how to do it. And with a lot of formerly incarcerated people, is that a lot what others don't understand is these people want to change. They want to do better. But how could they do better if they don't know how to do better? And I see this every day. I see different young adults coming to me saying, like, I want to do better. I want to move on with my life. I want to get better at being passionate about what I'm doing, things of that nature. But they don't know how to.
The how to reenter society and stem the rate of recidivism is what the city is addressing with beefed up education and training, reentry services, and transitional employment. De Blasio says the name of the game is to reduce incarceration. He says the city's jail population is down 18%, 23% for Rikers in the last 3 years. But the city needs to continue to drive down the rate of incarceration. The move to close Rikers has added steam with each new charge of abuse. At least 35 staff members at Rikers have faced criminal charges in the past 3 years, including 13 for assault or attempted assault. Federal prosecutors have also charged more than a half dozen Rikers guards with violating inmates' civil rights through excessive force, smuggling drugs, and other charges since 2014. Inmate activists have for more than a year argued that shutting down the sprawling 10-jail complex on the East River is the only solution for a cycle of abuses that include violence by guards and gang members, mistreatment of those with mental issues, and juveniles with unjustly long detention for minor offenders. The mayor says the whole jail system is what needs work.
A situation at Rikers, the status quo at Rikers, is not acceptable to us, and we've been continuing to change it, and we have to do that for people who are there right now. We're also going to make some decisions in the near term about what to do with the future of Rikers and the future of our jail system overall. And I've said to you guys repeatedly, we will do that by the time of the executive budget in the next weeks. So clearly, we're going to be giving you a bigger vision. But one thing that will be true even with that bigger vision, we have to do stuff immediately For those 8,500 people I mentioned who are sentenced every year, they need help now. We need to break that cycle now. So these are things we can do on top of all of the things that have been done to reduce violence on Rikers in the jail system, all the things that have been done to decrease the amount of weapons and contraband coming in. There's a whole host of reforms underway. Those all have to continue however we sort out the future.
For Stanley Richards of the Fortune Society, today is a day to celebrate.
This isn't about the conditions of confinement. This is about how do we invest in people? How do we build people? Fortune's tagline is build people, not prisons. This is an opportunity that this mayor is saying, we are going to invest in building people, giving people a second chance, building a pathway out of incarceration. And I just want us to take this moment and pause it for a moment, because it is an opportunity to build people.
In other news, advocates for the homeless are supporting a proposal called the Home Stability Support Program. They say it could drastically reduce and prevent homelessness in New York State. Andrea Sears reports.
There now are about 60,000 people living in homeless shelters in New York, and the cost of keeping a family in a welfare hotel can be $3,500 a month or more. According to Mark Greenberg, executive director of the Interfaith Assembly on Homelessness and Housing, the housing allowance currently given to people on public assistance simply isn't enough to cover the cost of a habitable apartment.
This home stability support would raise the level of the shelter allowance to around 85% of the prevailing rents in a particular area, and then the cities could make up the difference.
Home stability support is included in the Democratic-controlled State Assembly's budget plan, but may face opposition in the Republican-controlled Senate. Greenberg says home stability support would target people receiving public assistance and those in danger of becoming homeless, helping them stay in their homes.
People could continue to work and the kids could continue to go to school, and people would continue to have their support system as opposed to being pulled up from one place to another place where they don't know anyone. They can't really live a full life.
The plan approved by the Assembly would be phased in over 5 years with an initial state investment of $40 million. The New York City Comptroller estimates the plan would reduce the city's shelter population by 80% for families with children and 60% for adult families over 10 years. Greenberg believes approval of the measure should be beyond politics.
It makes sense. It saves money, and it also saves lives. There's really no reason to vote against it, except to use it as a bargaining chip for something else.
Last week, 95 faith leaders from 15 cities across the state signed a letter to Governor Andrew Cuomo urging him to support the plan. For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. Listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. Tom Price, the new Health and Human Services Secretary, went before a congressional appropriations panel today to answer questions about Donald Trump's proposed budget with deep cuts to medical research, public health, and social service programs. Price dodged repeated attempts to flush out Trump's next move on Obamacare. Most of the $1 trillion budget for health and human services is for entitlement programs like Medicare and Medicaid, which are insulated from the annual budgeting process. But the White House wants a 16% cut in everything else. The National Institutes of Health, the nation's premier medical research institution, faces a cut of nearly 20%. New York Representative Nita Lowey, addressing Tom Price today on Capitol Hill, says this is a really strange hearing.
You come before us with a, quote, a skinny budget that doesn't contain many numbers, and the few clear details would have catastrophic results for Americans. Here's what we know about President Trump's budget. The NIH would be cut by as much as $5.8 billion, resulting in 3,000 to 5,000 fewer annual research grants. Nursing training programs would be eliminated. Without LIHEAP, 6.8 million elderly and vulnerable Americans would be left without heating assistance in the winter and cooling assistance in the scorching summer heat. And the Department of Health and Human Services would be cut by 18%, putting critical priorities at risk. The 18% cut to HHS could endanger biosecurity, medical research, mental health counseling, substance abuse, early childhood development, combating disease and epidemics, vaccine development. I don't think I have enough time to list all the cuts, but you know how serious they are. There are no two ways about it. It's just not possible to make an 18% cut without decimating investments that Americans rely on. So we should be honest with the American people. President Trump's budget plans are nothing more than a broken promise. While special interest loopholes remain intact, if you're working hard every day and still can't make ends meet, you're out of luck in Trump's America. You also come before us days after Trump Care crashed and burned, with policy proposals constantly changing in an effort to appease the right wing in its final days. I'm not certain that any person in this room, perhaps including you, Mr. Secretary, could articulate the Trump administration policy on health care other than repealing the Affordable Care Act and taking health care away from 24 million people. I certainly hope, Mr. Secretary, that last week's failure of Trump Care has made clear that the American people want the ACA to be strengthened. And I think working together, Democrats and Republicans, if we look at it with open eyes, we can strengthen our health care system, especially in light of the news overnight that Republicans are back at trying to repeal the bill. I don't understand that. Instead of working together to improve, to strengthen the Affordable Care Act, without a plan in place, there's talk of repealing it again. And I want to make it very clear that we will call out any attempt by your department to undermine Americans' health coverage.
New York Congressmember Nita Lowey. California Representative Barbara Lee wants to know if Tom Price supports a boost in the military budget through cuts in his agency.
As you move, Mr. Secretary, to deconstruct your agency, do you support an increase of more than $54 billion for the Pentagon by paying for it through cuts at your agency, Health and Human Services?
Well, I think that it's important to address the premise.
No, Mr. Secretary, just yes or no?
No, I'm the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and I'm charged with a department of incredibly committed.
So your answer is no. You don't support.
But what I have the opportunity to work with are 76,000 individuals who are as dedicated as they.
No, Mr. Secretary, do you support increasing the military budget by over $54 billion by cuts at your agency?
Deconstructing the department is not a goal.
So you don't support it by paying for the increase in the Pentagon budget. You don't support the cuts in your agency to pay for the $54
billion. I'm the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And if you'd like to ask a question about Health and Human Services, I'd be pleased to answer.
Okay, Mr. Secretary, also as you move to deconstruct your agency, do you really believe or do you believe that low-income people deserve the same access to quality health care as upper-income individuals, the same quality health care?
That's been an absolute priority of mine since the day I entered public. No, since the day I went to medical school, is that every single American needs to have the access to the highest quality of care. And I must take issue with you again. It is not the goal of this secretary to deconstruct the department.
Mr. Secretary, your budget is deconstructing your agency.
This department affects every
billions.
Single American. And it is my responsibility to make certain that we provide the services in the most effective.
But, Mr. Secretary, your budget does not say that. It is a roadmap to deconstructing the entire agency, which you head.
With 2 minutes of questioning allotted Connecticut Congressmember Rosa DeLauro, she begins with funding cuts for LIHEAP, the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program. It provides help for nearly 7 million low-income households before she moves on to the NIH.
Mr. Secretary, quick, because I only have 2 minutes, yes or no answers. Do you support the elimination of LIHEAP? Yes or no? Move. I don't have time. Do you support the elimination of LIHEAP?
But the responsibility of the department is to make certain.
Do you support the elimination of LIHEAP? Yes or no?
The responsibility of the department is to make certain that the needs of the American people are met.
So that you support the elimination of LIHEAP, elimination of CSBG, yes or no?
What we're trying to do is to identify those.
Yes or no? Elimination of community services block grant.
And that there are other where there are partnerships.
No. Okay. NIH. The $1.2 billion Mr. Pocan spoke about. Do you support that? If your staff was looking at it, you must have been involved in that decision to go an additional $1.2 billion and a cut to the NIH in 2017. In 2018, do you support the $6 billion cut to the NIH?
It's been very clear in the remarks that have been had both by me and by others on the panel or by others on the committee.
Is a $6 billion cut to the NIH? Do you support it or no?
If there are efficiencies to be gained at NIH.
So you support a $6 billion cut in the NIH. Let me just ask you three or four other questions here. Have you divested yourself of all health care related investments? Yes or no?
As I said to the confirmation committee, that as we move through that process,
yes or no?
And the answer is yes.
Thank you. Have you fulfilled the terms of the ethics agreement worked out with the Office of Government Ethics?
Yes.
Okay. Will you send the subcommittee a letter attesting to fulfilling all the elements of your ethics agreement?
All of that is publicly available.
Okay. So can we get a copy
all
of
publicly
that?
Publicly available.
So we'll get it on our own. Just with my last 17 seconds, it would appear, Mr. Secretary, that one fact for all those who want to talk about the opioid crisis, that in fact, if you voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act, you would have voted to make the opioid crisis worse in this nation. You don't believe in insurers covering maternity care, pregnancy, newborn care, mental health services, and substance abuse treatment, all of which come out of your department. Mr. Secretary, I think you're at the top of doing what Ms. Leese talked about, is deconstructing an agency and dismantling health care in this country.
I would respectfully dispute that character.
I'm sure you would.
DeLauro says her sincere hope is that Trump's budget is dead on arrival. She says the budget is cynical, vindictive, and will cause real harm to millions of American families. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. The family of Emmett Till met with U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions seeking a conviction and the truth over what happened to their cousin, brutally murdered as a teen 61 years ago in Mississippi for allegedly whistling at a white woman. WBAI's Rebecca Miles has more.
Till's cousin, Deborah Watts, and Alvin Sykes, a member of the Emmett Till Justice Campaign, met with the head of the Justice Department, Jeff Sessions, on Tuesday. Till's murder was a catalyst to the civil rights movement. As well as seeking justice for the murdered cousin, they were also seeking support for the Emmett Till Unsolved Civil Rights Crimes Act. Sessions told them that no one is above the law, and he assured them justice would be served. The act directs the Department of Justice and the Federal Bureau of Investigation to coordinate the investigation and prosecution of civil rights-era homicides that occurred on or before December the 31st, 1969. The FBI is currently investigating or considering investigating 102 killings that occurred before the 1970s. It also directs the DOJ and the FBI to coordinate their activities with state and local law enforcement and to make annual reports to Congress on the progress of investigations and prosecutions falling under the Act. Watts told reporters that most of the cases were racially motivated murders. President Obama signed legislation in December last year that allowed the Department of Justice and the FBI to reopen unsolved civil rights crimes. The original bill, named after 14-year-old Emmett Till, who was kidnapped and brutally lynched by two white men for whistling at a white woman in 1955, was first introduced by Alvin Sykes in 2005. Sykes had promised Till's mum that he would pursue her son's case after the two men were acquitted. Till's mother insisted on an open casket funeral to show the world the mutilated body of her son. The brutality sparked outrage and helped galvanize the civil rights movement. Donham's first husband, Roy Bryant, and his half-brother, J.W. Millam, were acquitted of the murder, but both later claimed responsibility. A new book by author and historian Timothy B. Tyson argues the white woman told him a decade ago she wasn't telling the truth with her claims of sexual advances by the 14-year-old Chicago boy who was visiting family in rural Mississippi. Watts said they didn't talk in depth about the white woman's confession. Watts also said the next steps are to develop a master plan of the Emmett Till Civil Rights Crime Act with cooperation from the Justice Department. Rebecca Miles, WBAI News, New York.
And that's the WBAI Evening News for Wednesday, March 29th, 2017. The news was produced with Rebecca Miles, Andrea Sears, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York. Well,